Gemma. So we start a new volume, collected works of the mother, volume 12, which is titled On Education. Now before we proceed to this volume, one of the big problems that we all have is we have certain ideas associated with certain words. So whenever we talk about education, people start thinking right away that in a classroom setting, some teachers are practicing this over the children. This is automatic. We have this idea. But the mother has used the word education in a much more universal sense. Education is something going on all the time. So that's why she said it starts even before birth. And it goes on right throughout life. So first we must understand the background. So education is an ongoing process for the teacher as well as the taught. Second is, there are aspects in it quite naturally which if we try to implement it on children without really understanding, it can create its own difficulties. So I know that people read On Education volume and they want to implement it in a school setting. Many times they are not even aware of the little background note that mother has written. So they ask that, how are we going to tell them about psychic education or spiritual education? So obviously it is not done like that. If you try giving some kind of, it will change into doctrine. So for instance, let's just take the psychic education. So psychic and spiritual education is not religious education. It's not giving some doctrines of do's and don'ts or some mantra chanting and all these. This is not psychic and spiritual education. Psychic education is more of the nature of awakening. In fact, right now I'm using the two together. And there is a very beautiful little story in India which connects with how this kind of education can be transmitted. It is transmitted. It's not something which can be taught like a typical classroom method. So one of the stories goes that Uddalak is a sage and Shvetketu is his child. So he has studied a lot of Vedas and Upanishads and he knows the mantras and he is filled with the glory of the intellect. And he comes to his father, "Father, I have done, I have studied and I have sort of graduated in the Vedas, Upanishads." So he doesn't speak in this language, but as the story goes, he has studied the Vedas and the Upanishads. So his father says, "Oh, is it?" Then he starts asking some questions to his father, and the father asks some questions. So ultimately realizes that he actually knows nothing. And how does he awaken him finally? It's a very long passage of question answer, very nice format. If I remember, it's Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for those who want to, you know, go back to the source. A series of questions. So series of questions, and ultimately he asks his son, this example comes in other Upanishads also, that what does the tree come from? So he says, tree comes from the seed. So, okay, cut open the seed and look, what is the power? What do you find within the seed? Then he says, nothing. So the father says, this is the consciousness, which is, now, you know, it's nothing as far as our definitions, understanding goes, but it is the driving force within the atoms, the stars, the galaxies, the genes, because this is a question which modern mind raises, that how is it that genes suddenly act, they're unconscious, so how do they get switched on, switched off? It's quite a mystery. Now, if we find a process, the whole question will be only pushed one step backward. So what is it that determines ultimately that there is a kind of cosmic order in spite, I mean, despite the random events and the, you know, what is called as chaos when you go down and down? How does order emerge? So he just raises this question and suddenly Shvetketu has an aha phenomena. He says, oh, I see. And then he says that remarkable, famous verse, that you know Setkvetu, you too are that. Tat Tvamasi. Now you see, there is no formal teaching here. There is no points in psychic education, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's not, none of these things. For instance, a person deeply, one can approach it in many ways. For instance, you can take project beauty. And then start with what is your idea of beauty. One will start with beauty of form, this form, that form. But ultimately lead you to the beauty of the formless. Beauty of gestures, beauty of thoughts, beauty of feelings. You will end up discovering the all beautiful in this creation. And what is the master way of the psychic? What is it attracted towards? Truth, good and beauty. See, Satyam Shivam Sundaram. So when we teach a child, be truthful, you are basically instilling psychic education. So we don't have to use the word psychic, and we don't have to say, you know, there is a soul seated inside the heart. Now child begins to imagine all kinds of things. And this cannot be given until one is oneself awakened. Only somebody who is awakened can awaken another person. So teachers have to first, as I keep saying, that physician, heal thyself. Teacher, teach thyself. So unless you yourself is awakened to the psychic being and to the spiritual consciousness beyond, then this education you cannot impart. So this, it in fact, one will reduce it to a kind of doctrine, dogma, which is precisely what kills it. Because when you have doctrines and dogmas, you have given like a formula. But these are things which escape all mental formulas and rules and logic. So this is the background. The mother herself says why she... see, this volume contains three parts mainly. One is her articles and essays. Second are plenty of messages which are there on different occasions. And the third is her dramas. There are three dramas that the mother wrote. They are really amazing, wonderful. And we'll come to that when we come to that. So with regard to the articles, what it contains, she says something very interesting. Okay. Articles. So mother herself says something very interesting. In these articles, I am trying to put into ordinary terms the whole yogic terminology. See how she has freed everything from the trappings. The moment you use the word soul, God, it mind automatically brings certain ideas. Love, justice, freedom. Immediately the mind brings certain ideas. And then the divine consciousness, which should be experienced in all its purity, gets filtered through this idea, gets confined to the cabin of this idea, and it distorts the whole thing. So she says she's using... into ordinary terms, the whole yogic terminology, for these bulletins are meant more for people who lead an ordinary life. So this was through the bulletin of Center of Education. Though also for students of yoga. I mean people who are primarily interested in a purely physical material life, but who try to attain more perfection in their physical life than is usual in ordinary conditions. So, there are people who today react, and it's understandable. I don't believe in God. I remember one small little interaction with one of the school students. And after a talk, she says, 12th standard student, sir, basically I don't believe in God. I said, what God you don't believe in? Now, this is something which she thought some name of some God. But she understood the deeper sense of the question. So she says, I don't believe in a God who punishes. So I said, yes, I am absolutely on the same page with you. So then she was completely surprised because, you know, the whole idea is a conception of God. You can disbelieve in a conception of God. How do you disbelieve in God? I mean, it's a paradox. Because basically, you have an idea of God and God doesn't fit that bill. That is okay. You can disbelieve it or you can believe in it. But the reality is there behind this universe. And when you say that reality, then you can't deny that. So So then I asked, what kind of God you believe in? If you have to believe in a God, what kind of God? Say, God who is all love. I said, wonderful. I said, this is absolutely no problem at all. But you see, she says, everybody has a problem with me when I say I don't believe in God. I said, don't worry. And I said, don't worry, God believes in you. That's important. Because God has become all this. So this is a problem which we find in the Semitic conception and Indian conception, which Mother has pointed out. Says this idea of God is somewhere and He made the world is very different from the Indian conception where God has become the world. Now it changes the whole thing. You can't say God made this horrible world and put us in. You have to say that God became this world. Why did He become this? So then you find the real solution. You start seeing that why has He become this and what is He becoming out of this. Then it at least the God is the moral responsibility of creating a hell and then pushing souls into it, that is taken away. So first she says that. And then she says, it is a very difficult task, but it is a kind of yoga when people are in ordinary conditions. So at one place Mother says, to be a wife, just a true wife, is no less than a yoga. It's a great yoga. To be really, anything you pick up, if you practice qualities of truthfulness and faithfulness and honesty and service, you will realize the divine, because you are actually all these qualities. So many people who don't understand Indian culture find it very difficult that, you know, it used to be like that. But there was a logic behind it. Of course, that logic we have lost. That system is gone for good, and that's nice it has gone, because it became subject to misuse. So, but that's the whole logic. So then she says, these people call themselves materialists, and they are apt to get agitated or irritated if yogic terms are used. So one must speak their language, avoiding terms likely to shock them. But I have known in my life persons who call themselves materialists and yet followed a much severer discipline than those who claim to do yoga. And today someone posted that on the group, that Da Vinci was a yogi. He didn't, if you asked him, are you a yogi? He would say, I don't know what yogi is. Are you chanting some mantra? You would say, probably, I don't know what mantra you are talking about. But he's a yogi. He had the vision of the mother. If you see his film on how he painted the famous Mona Lisa painting, it's an amazing film. And actually, because he had lost his mother very early on in child, and when somebody asked one of the kings to paint his mother, and there was no picture of his mother. So he says, I can't, because there were no photography at that time. So he has to paint a picture of someone's mother from his imagination. So he conceives what mother is, and he never had a mother, fortunately, in that sense. So he conceives of the universal mother, what a mother would be. And he presents that. Now people often say, is it a man or a woman? They don't understand that what it represents is a mother can play both the roles, if necessary, of a man and a woman, of a mother and a father. Her enigmatic smile. So he has actually brought into frame the eternal feminine. So this is something very beautiful about... So he was a yogi, she says. And the kind of discipline, the kind of art. But if you asked him, he would say no. Traditionally also, he'll not go in the list or pantheon of yogis. And there have been others like that. People talk about miracles. Even, of course, people try to explain. Sri Aurobindo, with regard to Napoleon, says that I saw the arm of God striding through Europe. Napoleon was a vibhuti, that he says very clearly. He has a whole poem on it. And Napoleon Bonaparte, when his body is exhumed after quite a few years, or probably decades definitely, it had not shown signs of decay. Now people are explaining it that it was embalmed and all fine. But what an embalming. So there have been people like that. Newton, Isaac Newton, I'm giving just random. His whole side of writings which are occult, they were all suppressed. suppressed by the church, suppressed by the scientific community, because you're not supposed to talk about these things or know about these things. So there are people who are in ordinary lives, apparently materialists, they would pass off as anybody, nobody, everybody, but they are yogis. So mother knows about them and she is talking about them. What we want is that humanity should progress. Whether it professes to lead a yogic life or not matters little, provided it makes the necessary effort for progress. What wideness she has, you know, put everything. And then we have these few articles on this. This is the part one. And each article is a marvel. And we'll just pick up some Bija Mantras, Sutras from these articles. And the very first is the science of living. She explains the art of living also, but that follows. So science is to know, art is to live always. So science is about knowledge, art is when you apply this knowledge in multiple spheres of life. So science of living is to know oneself and to control oneself. This is the package. And these first few lines, which are so important. An aimless life is always a miserable life. So that's, so many years of my practice, I see people are unhappy. One of the reasons is they don't know the aim. And if you tell them, they will say, no, yeah, I know. What do you want to do? I want to, you know, do this job. I want to. Worse still, I'll take up a job, then I'll get married, I'll have children, I'll have a house and car and settle down somewhere. And as life passes by, there is greater and greater misery. And they try to escape from that misery through parties, through all kinds of things which will give them an artificial kick. And the proof is the kind of, you know, whether it's alcohol, drugs, pornography, name it. Instant pleasure. All the McDonald's and everything thrives on this. That there is a hollowness, emptiness, lack of natural joy. So people are running from here and there, because they don't have an aim. They don't understand what is an aim. So, first sutra. Then she says, every one of you should have an aim. But do not forget that on the quality of your aim will depend the quality of your life. So, recently I had a little exchange where this aim thing comes in. So, the person says, isn't the aim of life that, you know, you should look after the family like a duty? Typical Indian question. So, I said, tell me, where is it mentioned? So, if you take the dharma, so dharma of the Brahmin is to gather knowledge and share it freely with the world. The dharma of the Kshatriya is to stand up for the right, the true, the noble, the beautiful. The dharma of the Vaishya is to have this, to bring out things, production, beautiful things, and to circulate it in the world. Circulation of the money force, the vital energy, interchange, conscious interchange. And the dharma of the Shudra is to serve and to manifest beauty through material objects and whatever he is doing. I said, strangely, in none of this dharma, it is mentioned that they should look after the family. Now, family looking after is important, I am not saying, but it's incidental, it's not the goal of life. So many people take it that, you know, my parents are my God and I need to just take care of them. And that's my whole dharma. No, it cannot be a dharma. It's okay, there are things in your life which are there. And one accepts it and carries it along. That's inevitable. But dharma is something so deep. So she's saying if your aim is small, your life will also be very small. And if your aim is big and high, then your life will also take that surge. So she says your aim should be high and wide. So there are small aims, narrow aims, and the aims which are like highest aim, becoming one with the divine. That's the highest aim. Realizing the highest possibility, high aim. Wide aim, not only for myself, but for the whole world. That's a wide aim. Like I don't want mukti for myself, but I want it, you know, imperfect is the joy, not shared by all. That's a wide aim. Generous and disinterested. Of course, the word disinterested is not uninterested. It means not being done for any personal purposes. That's disinterested. It's not like because my ego is taking a personal interest in it, therefore it's my aim. My kind, my tribe, my people. Now that's very vested interest. But an aim which is disinterested, and generous, not done only for one's small little self. This will make your life precious to yourself and to others. So this is one of the Mahasutras that the world is suffering because it doesn't have even a basic aim. But whatever your ideal, it cannot be perfectly realized unless you have realized perfection in yourself. Here at another place, Mother says something very interesting. The more you realize perfection within you, the more you are likely to see it in others. Otherwise, you'll see this world nothing else but if you are seeing darkness everywhere, possibly you need to take off your goggles. Maybe you are wearing the wrong number or the wrong, because you are seeing everything distorted. So if that is the state, so basically it goes back to world is a mirror. The more we realize, and it's true, one cannot realize the beauty of others or some form or the other unless you have discovered something in yourself. That's why those who work within themselves become very generous towards others. They become very tolerant because they know how difficult it is to strive. So they begin to recognize, say, the sacrifice of a common person in ordinary life. The kind of, I have seen, made an observation that the richer you become, the more miser you become. And the more, the lesser you have, I have seen these, see, you begin to recognize it, smiling. So many women you will see here, men, auto rickshaw driver, the person who is, the vendor who is selling, what lovely, beautiful smile. And, you know, in the hot summer sun, and they are, you bargain with them something which is for 50 rupees. I mean, one should never bargain, but I'm saying there are people who will, 50 rupees, they'll say 40, and the person will, with a smile, give you. Do this in a big shop, branded shop, they'll throw you out. Tell them, aren't you charging 5,000 is a little too much for this shoe? And tell him, I can get it in Sarojini Nagar market for 500 rupees. See the reaction, as if you are some kind of uncouth fellow. Means the sole right of cheating is with the brands. And everybody knows the game. And everybody bears that brand, and people, oh, it's a brand statement. See how the world of falsehood works. But the more you work within yourself, get rid of all this show and sham, the more you recognize, here is a person in very ordinary dress, but look at him or look at her, how beautiful that smile is. Today we saw, no, that auto rickshaw driver, such a lovely smile, old man, and suddenly, you know, he told something to her, and you know, it was like so nice, spontaneous gesture. And then that's why I asked that, what was your experience? Because there are people, no, will say, this is bad, that is bad. But it's not true. Your vision needs to be corrected. So, she says that you have to realize perfection within yourself. Nobody else, mind your own business. Nobody else's business. And then she says, to work for your perfection, the first step. The first step is to become conscious of yourself, of the different parts of your being and their respective activities. What is being pushed by the vital? There are so many people who are pushed by the vital. They think it's soul, it's spiritual. Communist word is soulmate. Communist thing is that, you know, my soul wants this. So one should be very careful. One should accept that, well, this is a vital thing. It's my emotions. Fine, nothing wrong. You're not committing a sin. But once you acknowledge, then you begin to slowly work upon this part. If you don't acknowledge, we keep justifying it, then, you know, it'll take very, very long. So this is about just a few sutras. There are plenty. This is a long article. But it closes with something very beautiful. When we reach this degree of perfection, which is our goal, we shall perceive that the truth we seek is made up of four major aspects. So this makes a complete man or a woman. So it's a package. If you want to strive towards perfection. Perfection is not one quality, reaching its highest. It's a roundedness, it's a totality. And that totality where everything is in harmony with each other, not just discordantly. So what are these four major aspects? Love, knowledge, power and beauty. Later on she'll explain, psychic is the receptacle of love, vehicle of love, knowledge, the mind, power, life and beauty in the physical. So these are the four aspects of these four attributes of the truth will express themselves spontaneously in our being. The psychic will be the vehicle of true and pure love. The mind will be the vehicle of infallible knowledge. And all of them should be there. It's not like, okay, I am only a bhakti. I don't care about wisdom. I don't care about anything. Knowledge is important because love, when it is there is no background of knowledge, can easily turn blind and can easily fall. So all of them are together. The vital will manifest an invincible power and strength. This, of course, not brute power and strength, but the strength that can face a million obstacles and yet remains unflinched. It's the strength that gives us the capacity to endure things. It's the power that never says that things are hopeless. Even after failing 1,000 times, you are ready to get up 1,001 times. That's the power which continues to strive and labor. And finally, and the body will be the expression of a perfect beauty and harmony. So this is how she closes this chapter. Plenty of things to read and meditate upon. And then she says about education. This is the second article. The education of a human being should begin at birth and continue throughout his life. So there is no degrees. One of the things that is good about the ashram school is there are no degrees. And I believe degrees have done a lot of harm. So you get in medical school, we get a degree. And it automatically gives you the idea that you know. And you know better than a person who doesn't have a degree. And sometimes you are in for surprise. When one patient told me that, "Doctor, do you know my body better than myself?" I said, "I completely agree with you." Yes, but see a typical doctor. You don't know. You better take this. This cholesterol is going to harm you immediately. So this is all because you believe that you know. Why? Because you have read a book. Have you read the Veda of, Veda of the body? The book of the body. This body is such a complex, wonderful machine evolved through millenniums and trillenniums. Just looking at the body, I'm just giving one example in the medical field. And a doctor says in one lifetime or last few 100 years of research, we have understood all about the body. What nonsense is this? It has evolved with intricate processes and it continues to evolve through all the challenges. How is it? How does it work? So, but we believe that we know. So we stop once we get a degree. And that is the difference between truly wise doctors. I'm talking about doctors, engineers, could be any field, educationists. That they are always keep a space open for the divine wisdom which is escaping them. So when people live in a very too formulated life, so I tell them, please give some space for God to act. Otherwise, everything you have decided, I have this, I have that, and it will happen like this, it will happen like that. Thodi jagah to chhod do Bhagwan ke liye. Let poor God. Because how will he intervene? You have created a whole formation around yourself and around the patient of illness, of things. And there is no scope, no space. So things go according to that formation. Then you say, see, didn't I say? You justify, it's called as self-fulfilling prophecy. You believe in something strongly, that's how things will be. And you feel that this is truth. It's not truth. It's a belief replicating itself like a pattern, like a habit, million times, but that doesn't make it truth. So this very interesting thought. So she says it continues throughout life. So we should be always keen to know more, to learn more, through progress more, through whatever sources. begin at birth. And then she says, indeed, if we want this education to have its maximum result, it should begin even before birth. In India, now at least, Shobindu devotees and people who are into Vedas, they are picking up from the Vedas and they are beginning to speak about conscious conception, because it was there in Indian thought. It's part of Atharva Veda, one of the Upavedas, which is called Garbhadhan Sanskar. So it's about conscious conception. At least when the baby is conceived, they talk about it. But the mother takes it even one step further, of even conceiving a child consciously. Which is, she has actually, everything they have touched, they have taken it to yet another level. So, but traditionally it is like when the baby is there in the womb, how you are going to go about it. So there is a whole process that the education is beginning before birth. When a child is conceived, your thoughts, your feelings, this knowledge is there now. It has, time to time you will see a mainstream doctor talking about it, that well, mother's thoughts, anxieties, fears are affecting the child. But in practice, it's hardly put into practice. It's all, have you taken your tetanus shot? Have you got your blood pressure tested? Albumin tested in the urine? Standard, all good, okay. So, that's the unfortunate part. So now she comes to parenting, plenty of things. As I said, I'm just picked up some sutras. With very few exceptions, parents are not aware of the disastrous influence that their own defects, impulses, weaknesses, and lack of self-control have on their children. So we give a package. Mother says that sometimes it has been said that birth can be a purge. Very strong words. Shiva starts, what does it mean? He says, sometimes people who hide their shadow, they just transmit it to the child. It's like a release. It's a purge. So all their shadows they have thrown into the child. And the child is quite different. And you know, parents just wonder, oh, we are very nice people. And how is the child like that? Because they passed it on. Obviously, unwittingly most of the time. So how conscious one has to be. And then one very interesting sutra for parents of today who say that children don't respect us anymore. So the question is, why will they? Why should they? And she is giving a very interesting reason. If you wish to be respected by a child, have respect for yourself and be worthy of respect at every moment. This is an observation I have made several times. They very much respect if you are worthy of respect. They will not respect just because you are a father or mother or a teacher or an elder. They will not respect because the age of truth has come. So you can't tell them, you know, I am your dad and you treat me like this. You may be dad or I am Guruji. You have to, you know, you have to, you know, you can't demand respect by authority. Either it will be commanded simply because you are what you are. And then I've seen that children do have all these things. It's not true that they don't respect. They respect a lot. Lot of love they can give. But if you try to extract it by force because I am somebody or someone, simply in age, I was born as, you know, some children say, and so funny. Oh, to respect you just because you were born a little before me. So I add that who knows, this chit of a fellow was, because we believe in rebirth, is wiser than you. That's the truth of matter. You know, we have such examples in Nachiketa. And this is Indian thought for those who, for, you know, who say, no, this is degenerating. See, in Indian thought, you have Nachiketa. Krishna himself is a rebel. Who kills his mama? Tell me. His own mama. Bare hands. Because it's not about, you don't deserve respect just spontaneously because you are a relation. And that's why he commands Arjun. Don't see this, see dharma and act. So who can say this? Because, you know, you don't respect simply because you are my grandsire and you are this or that. You are an authority figure. So this is the new age. Parents, be careful. So she says, if you wish to never be authoritarian, despotic, despotic, impatient or ill-tempered. If you do that, you have lost it. Mother says people who get very angry with children, children stop respecting them. They may out of courtesy or something outwardly say things, but you have lost because you have fallen in their eyes. They may not tell you that you are a joker, but basically they feel that. And this is what is happening all over the world today because a new age of truth has started. People often say this is Kali Yuga. No, this is the beginning. Because Kali Yuga is authority, ego, falsehood. You have to listen. Now children don't listen to that. They openly say things. Okay, so so plenty of interesting things for parents. Then she says, another pitfall to avoid. Do not scold your child without good reason and only when it is quite indispensable. A child who is too often scolded gets hardened to rebuke and no longer attaches much importance to words or severity of tone. So when you have never expressed anger, you generally don't express. But if sometimes you express, use words which are strong, they have a great impact. They can almost have a devastating impact. Some of these rishis were like that. They were not like they were quick to anger, not like that. But when they expressed it, it carried all the power that was accumulated. So it was a force in action which did, it worked to remove something, some obstacle from a person. When a child has done something wrong, see that he confesses it to you spontaneously and frankly. And when he has confessed with kindness and affection, make him understand what was wrong in his movement so that he will not repeat it, but never scold him. A fault confessed must always be forgiven. And she says, you should not allow any fear to come between you and your child. Fear is a pernicious means of education. It invariably gives birth to deceit and lying. So that's why now we have that question. Why freedom? People often ask, why freedom is given? With that we can close this today. Why there is freedom given so much in the ashram? Everywhere you will have some kind of either fear, some punishment, some, oh, master will get angry, or you will punish, you will rot in hell, God knows somewhere. There is a hell for everything that you do. So the problem with that is, it's like when you control things by legislation or by law, whether a divine law or a human law. They are the two laws which have operated in the world, religious sanction or human constitution. When you are doing because of that fear, then nothing has changed inside. The moment you get an opportunity, you will ultimately do what your nature is. That's why people often ask today, why are so many youngsters indulging in pornography? Exactly for this reason. Because till now the control was always some kind of external authority, some kind of external fear. Now you have scope of so many things with the modern freedom. At the same time, the change is the same person which has continued. You see soldiers, very disciplined lot. But, I mean, first of all, hats off to Indian soldiers. At least I know that they're really, really disciplined. They won't do a thing like, it's just inbuilt. Also inbuilt because of the culture. So if you go to a place like Ladakh borders, you see lines from the Gita and these things. They inspire the Indian soldiers. But at the same time, you see soldiers in many places. Soldiers have been generally a disciplined lot. You can't fight a war where life and death. But the moment they conquer, they do the worst possible things. Loot, plunder, rape, call it and they do it. What happens to all the discipline? Because now there is no law, there is nobody to be afraid of. They get a sanction. So a lot of things are happening today because things were kept under check, under authority. And fear. Now fear changes nothing inside a human being. So that's why Mother and Sri Aurobindo say freedom. So why freedom? Even freedom to hang yourself at the end. Why? Shobhinda was asked this. He says, because you cannot create supermind in any other way. Evolution has to be through conscious choices. It's a constant learning process. Anything which is suppressed by fear. You see Islam, one of the religions of peace. Where there is... sorry, but... I must say peace be upon. So you see, where there is so much of control by fear. You are not supposed to do this. You are not supposed to... if you commit a theft, you will be stoned or you will know, you will be chopped off your hands. If you commit adultery, there will be a mob-like violence. Look what have they done to the world and continue to do. The moment they get a chance. From harems to ransacking places to, you know, destroying temples, looting this Tamur fellow. Because fear does nothing. It just suppresses everything. It's all bottled and the day it comes out. It's terrible. It's disastrous. So fear cannot change anything. So Mother and Shobhinda's method is freedom. And I may add, who can give absolute freedom, so called? Who is absolutely in control and master? Someone asked another yogi in Tiruvannamalai, how come everywhere you have certain rules and regulations, no discipline? At least you will have women on one side and men on one side. People have not noticed these things because they have not gone to places, no? So even because we are so used to it, in Kumbh, I had a problem because we went to, somebody said, you please come and eat one of the Guruji's. So we went, like ashram, we sat, no. Only men will sit here. Women, we are not used to men and women. We have forgotten that. So suddenly we saw, yes, there are men sitting in one row. And what is there if we eat together? Every day we are eating together. But that's how it is. So when you do this kind of thing, so but Sri Aurobindo ashram, there is no such rule. So he asked that, how come in Sri Aurobindo ashram we don't have such rules and people are allowed freedom, boys and girls are mingling freely? Is it not like putting fire and butter together? That's how the person asked. So that yogi said, yes, but Sri Aurobindo is divine. He can do it because he is master. He has that capacity that wherever my child goes, however far, once he has accepted in the yoga, he brings you back in whatever way, through whatever experiences. It's a sign of a complete power. That's how the divine, the creation has been built on the principle of freedom. Because only the absolutely powerful can allow you, because no, kehte hain kahan tak jayega bachche, how far will you go? The rope is in my hands. Only the supreme power can exercise, grant such a freedom. This is just to, as an aside, that it's not fear, but freedom. But behind the freedom, freedom is again, since we have used the word, do anything you feel like. Freedom means you have to educate. That's what education is about. Children don't know that this is good for themselves, to discipline for your own sake. Nobody else is there to do it. That discipline gives you power. That discipline gives you actually more freedom. Because it allows you to operate and function in a much better way. So self-discipline, a simple thing like regulating time. You want to go somewhere, you regulate your time. Your money, how much you are spending. It gives you, it actually trains you, educates you. Nobody is there to tell you about it. But it helps you to master yourself. And when you master yourself, then you actually augment your freedom. So that's how one has to understand. Freedom is again not doing whatever you feel like. But it means you make your choices. You grow sincere because you are here for that. So to remind why one is here for, what one is here for, what is one's best possibilities, best abilities. Then slowly that's what is called as education, induced to bring out. And as these things come out, the best comes out. As Sri Aurobindo defines education is to educe, to bring out that which is best and to put it for the highest and noblest use. So best is, well, we can put a name to it. So best within a human being. What is the best possibility? And then not just bring out the best, But to put it for a high and noble use, this defines education. And it's only possible when there is freedom and not fear. But freedom with a gentle molding, leading, guiding, like Krishna playing the flute. It's an amazing image with which we can stop this part. See, how does Krishna drive the herds? What is the, you know, normally you drive the herds with a some whiplash or something like that, no? Because you have to, or some, because if they go astray, you have to bring them back. What is Krishna doing? He's doing nothing. He's just playing the flute. He knows they will follow me. That is the sign of great power. So this is how one should be, that the teacher should be such that disciples feel, or the students feel, ah, this is an example worth emulating. That is the way. And that's what we see in Sri Aurobindo and the mother. They would rarely say, do this, don't do this. There were many reasons why. But they will say, well, if you do this, this how, it's, you know, it's better if you avoid this, that's how. Even to his own brother, Sri Aurobindo did not stop him when he wanted to go away. Can you imagine? He doesn't counsel him or give him advice. So you don't know what you're going to miss. He just lets him go. That is the kind of freedom that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have given to all creatures. Chema.